previously on Joseph. God's dreams come true. In Genesis chapter 37, we met Joseph, who was one of 12 brothers in a pretty crazy family, and he was the favorite. His father, Jacob, loved him more than any of the rest, and everyone knew it, because he even dressed Joseph in this ornate, multicolored robe, and so he visibly stood out from his brothers. Now, his brothers hated him for this. They were very jealous of him, and it didn't help that Joseph started having dreams from God that one day all of his brothers would bow down to him, and that even his mother and his father would one day bow down to him. His brothers were jealous, and they wanted to get rid of him. One day, they got their chance. Dad sent Joseph out to the fields to check on how the work was going with his brothers and to see how the flocks were doing, but they saw him coming from a long way off, and they said, "Here comes that dreamer." And they plotted to kill him. And they said, "We'll see what comes of his dreams then." Reuben, the oldest brother, didn't want to kill Joseph, so he convinced his brothers, "Let's not shed any blood. Instead, we'll throw him in this cistern." And Reuben was thinking he'd secretly come back later and save him. Well, opportunity knocked when Ishmaelite traders came by, and his brothers said, "Why kill him when we can sell him?" And they sold him into slavery for a paltry sum. Joseph was betrayed. And in one moment, God's dreams for Joseph came crashing against the cold, hard reality that this world will oppose God's dreams for you. Now, we continue the story in Genesis chapter 39. Joseph has been sold into slavery, and one of Pharaoh's top officials, the captain of the guard, a man named Potiphar, bought him and put him to work in his household. For any outside observer looking in, it would have seemed as if God had completely abandoned Joseph. But that is not what the text said. We start in Genesis chapter 39, verse 2. It says, "The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had in Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything except the food that he ate." I had an experience personally when I was a teacher for the New York City Department of Ed that made me keep thinking of this moment in Joseph's life. You know, teaching is a very difficult job anywhere, and teaching in public schools is on a whole different level, and teaching in New York City public is on a whole different level. And I was in a really difficult situation. In addition to the regular job, which is preposterously difficult, teaching all these different kids with all of their issues and grading all the papers and prepping all the work and doing all the extra stuff and visiting families and calling home and all that stuff. In addition to that, there's this like crushing weight of extra stuff that they're always expecting you to do. And it was preposterous. At any given time, there was 12 things that they're asking me to do, and I maybe had time to do one, maybe, if I was going to be even remotely sane emotionally. So I, for really the first time in my life, started to pray differently. I started to pray these like desperate, childlike prayers, like crying out to God because I was really in out of my depth. And like, "God, I can't get this done. Show me what to do. Cover for me. I can't get those things done. I need you to cover for me." And the thing is, he started to do that. Out of the 12 things I was supposed to do, I would do the one thing that they came and asked about. So I would just feel like this burning in my gut, like, "You've got to get your assessment binder together." And over 2 or 3 days, I would put together this amazing assessment binder with individualized plans for student remediation in there or whatever. And then there would be a surprise inspection, and they would come around asking for the assessment binder. And I looked like a master. I mean, I looked like a complete master. And I felt like God was, like, covering for me. Or they'd say, "We're going to go do a surprise inspection of all the bulletin boards, and you've got to have fresh student work with all lined up with a rubric, and everything's got to be dated and recent and all that." And the day prior, I would have stayed 5 hours after school changing over all my bulletin boards and putting up extra work. And over time, I looked like a master. Meanwhile, other teachers were getting disciplinary letters in their file. A teacher was let go. A teacher had her pension taken away from her. I mean, it was this like high, challenging environment, but God kept covering for me. And the only way I can describe it is I had favor. After that happened about 10 times, the administration concluded this guy is a master teacher, and they totally backed off of me, and they never even asked me for anything after that. But the thing is, I wasn't. If they'd asked me for any of the 10 other things I was supposed to do, I would have looked completely unprepared and incompetent. But while I was in that setting, when this started happening, I kept thinking of the way Joseph got favor, and it felt like the same thing happening to me. So this is the scene for this act of Joseph's story that you need to understand. But there's one other thing you need to understand to know where this thing is going, and that's in verse 6. Now Joseph was well-built and handsome. Let me just pause right there for a second. When the Bible says you're well-built and handsome, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say, you're a pretty good-looking guy. I mean, he said he's handsome and he's well-built. He's got a nice body. God said he has a nice body. I didn't say it. God, I mean, like Cosmos, 20th sexy man, eat your heart out. The Bible said Joseph is a good-looking guy. Now, while that's not his fault, it does get him into some trouble in verse 7. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, come to bed with me. Whoa, 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 Potiphar's wife. No dinner? I mean, like, that's like, talk about 0 to 60 in no time flat. Like, she takes notice of him and says, come to bed with me. Now, usually when this story is told and we imagine it, or at least how I've imagined it, I always imagine kind of an older woman, like a cougar. And I don't know if that's because, like, Potiphar was the captain of the guard, so he was probably more mature, and so his, you know, probably his wife was older or whatever. But actually, I'm not so sure that that was true. Potiphar was a fighting man. He might have been in his prime or just past his prime, and it was very common to marry women who are much younger than you were, especially for a powerful man like that. And really, my perspective on this started to change when I saw my wife play Potiphar in a performance of Joseph in the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Potiphar's wife. The production company is totally strapped for funds. She played Potiphar and Potiphar's wife. So my wife played Potiphar's wife, and you know, and actually the guy that played Joseph was a music minister at another church, and I sat next to his wife on opening night, and it was like, oh, this is awkward, isn't it, right here? And but so that started to change. Like, maybe she wasn't this older woman. And regardless, I actually think that this was a legitimate temptation. I think that Joseph was legitimately tempted to do this because of the way he responds later. The reasons he gives for why he will not respond are not, I'm not attracted to you, or you're repulsive, or I don't want anything to do with you. I think this was a legitimate temptation. And let's just think for a moment how easy it would have been for Joseph to respond to this temptation. I mean, first off, this is a powerful woman. You know, she's the wife of his master. So this is like sexual harassment got all over it. I mean, he's her slave. And she's saying, come to bed with me. So, I mean, he could have given in just on that. What choice do I have? I'm her property. What else can I do? But more than that, it would have been so easy for Joseph to say, you know what? Why not? His dreams of, you know, his brothers bowing down to him and him being in charge probably seemed like a very distant memory at this point in his life. They probably seemed like the silly daydreams of a naive boy. And it's not like it's been smooth sailing since then. I mean, it's been one disappointment after another. And so I could very easily hear him saying to himself, you know what? Why not? Why not? I'm in this difficult situation. I'm in this caustic environment, and I'm making the best of it. I've worked my way up the ranks through this unjust situation. Why not a little something for me along the way? I mean, why not a little pleasure? And Joseph is a red-blooded man, and this woman is offering himself to her. So I think this was a legitimate temptation. It would have been so easy for Joseph to say, I'm just going to give into this. My whole life is on plan B right now. God's dreams for me are dead. Why even bother? But he doesn't. And I want you to pay very careful attention to why he doesn't. We pick up the story in verse 8. But he refused. With me in charge, he told her, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and, catch this right here, and sin against God? Now, I think Joseph was a nice guy. I think he had integrity. And I think he cared for his master, and he thought, you know, this guy didn't have to promote me. He didn't have to give me a good position in his house, but he did. He's promoted me, and he's trusted me, and I'm a man of my word. He's trusted me with everything but you, so I'm not going to go against him. But I think what it really came down for Joseph is that he did not want to sin against God. I think Joseph saw this for what it was. It was temptation, pure and simple. And Joseph was experiencing something that every single one of us experience in life. And that is, temptation is a test of what you really want. Temptation is a test that determines what you really want. This was a test. Did Joseph really want God's dreams, or would he settle? Did he want the dream that God gave him, or would he settle for being the slave master of this household? Did he want the dreams that God gave him, or would he settle for another man's wife? What did he really want? This was a test. Did he want comfort and pleasure now, or did he really want God's dreams come true? Temptation is a test that determines what you really want. And given that reality, I want to recommend that you do what Joseph did. And do not let what you want get in the way of what you really want. No dejes que lo que tú quieres se interponga en lo que verdaderamente quieres. Don't let what you want get in the way of what you really want. The problem is, most people have no idea what they really want. They're defenseless against what they want because they have no idea what they really want. So it's not even a choice for them. I don't know what I really want, so what do I want? That's just what I'm going to do. And so the best defense you can give yourself against caving into what you want that isn't what you really want is becoming clear about what you really want. And that's why 2 weeks ago when we started this series, I encouraged all of you to take the dream worksheet that we made and go find an hour and get alone with God and generate a bunch of dreams for your life. The what do I really want kind of dreams. If you took the time to do that, you are light years ahead of a lot of other people in terms of how much you understand what you really want in life. And we're doing that because we believe God's dreams for us, he often communicates to us through our own dreams. And so if you paid attention to the categories like character and relationships and spiritual life and legacy, I guarantee you have a much better idea of God's dreams for you than many other people have. If you did not have the chance to do that or you weren't here, go to our website, everydaycc.com. Across the top, you'll find podcasts. Click on that, listen to the message, or find it on iTunes. It's free. And then on your way out today, we have a few extra of those worksheets. Grab one of those worksheets and find an hour over the next 2 weeks to generate your dream list, because you've got to know what you really want or you're going to fall victim to what you want. Now, let me help explain that a little bit. Let me take some money examples because they're easy to wrap our mind around. Let's say on your dream list, you put, I want to travel to Europe. And that's probably a good one because I think most of us probably have some kind of travel dream somewhere on our list or somewhere in our hearts. So if you, let's say that's one that you want to focus on right now. You can't focus on all your dreams all at once. You probably can't even do all your dreams in the course of one lifetime. But if you do focus on a few of them at a time, you will be shocked at how many of them you do throughout the course of your lifetime. Let's say you're focusing on that one right now. I want to go to Europe, and you're thinking through all that means. I need money, I need time off work, I might need to get Rosetta Stone, I need to do some research, like whatever that means for you to go to Europe, for that trip to be fun for you. So you need money. Meanwhile, you want to go out to eat tonight. You want to go out to eat tonight. Now, if you don't know what you really want, then it's just, do I want to go out to eat tonight or not? And of course you do. Yes, you want to go out to eat tonight. If you know what you really want, then this question isn't that simple. It's, do I want to go out to eat tonight, or do I want to set that money aside so I can go out to eat in Rome? It's a very different decision right there. If you know what you really want, you're less vulnerable to what you want. Or let's say that your dream is to get yourself out of debt, which I hope that for anyone who's in debt, that will be one of your dreams, to one day be out of debt. Because just imagine the feeling of like being financially beholden to none, paying for things in cash, having that monkey off your back. So that could be a dream, to be out of debt. If you didn't know that was a dream, if you didn't name it, then you might be thinking like, okay, to get a novel from the library instead of going to see a movie at the theater, that's like a step down for me. But if you know getting out of debt is a dream, it's not a step down, it's a choice. I'm choosing to get the novel from the library instead of going to the movie because I'd rather use that money to pay down debt because that's a dream. I want to be out of debt. What this is tapping into is something psychologists call a sense of delayed gratification. I've mentioned it before, I will mention it again. It's one of the most important mental faculties you can develop as you mature emotionally and spiritually. The sense of delayed gratification is basically the ability to say, I'm going to withhold something from myself now so that I can have something better later. I'm going to delay gratification. I'm going to wait till later. And a sense of delayed gratification is immensely important, but it's really hard to develop and maintain because the present screams at us. So like one study I read recently about this, they used age progression software to show people what they would look like in the future, theoretically, if they made different choices. So like you could do choices like, I'm going to save more and spend less, and your aged face would become happier in the future. Because if you think about it, present Chris would be happier if past Chris had saved more. So future Chris probably will be happier if present Chris starts saving more, right? So, and then they would do stuff with like smoking. They'd show the age progression face like get all wrinkly and unhealthy looking, or like eating. They'd show like I'm going to eat more and exercise less, and like the age progression face would get overweight, or you choose healthier things and they'd get healthier. And all of that was doing was trying to help people's mind's eye cast into the future and imagine their future selves and feel empathetic towards your future self and then make choices today that will impact the happiness of future self. Now, I think we all kind of get that, but it's so tough to do it because the present screams at you. Lindsay and I had a friend who had a mantra on her refrigerator that said, "Nothing tastes as good as being thin feels." And I get that because that's a don't let what you want get in the way of what you really want kind of thing. What do you really want? You want to be thin. So don't let what you want, things that taste good, get in the way of what you really want. I totally get that. The problem is, I read that, nothing tastes as good as being thin feels, and I say red velvet cake. And the problem is, if I haven't named what I really want, to be healthy, to be energetic, to have a healthy heart, to live a long life, well, all the things that I really want, if I haven't named that, I'm defenseless against red velvet cake. If you ask me like morning, noon, night, do you want red velvet cake? Yes. If you ask me right after I had a piece of red velvet cake, would you like red velvet cake? Yes. The answer is always, I'm never going to be like, no, no, I don't want that. I always want it, but that's not the real question. The question is, what do I really want? What do I want more? Do I want the piece of red velvet cake or do I want to be healthy, this deeper dream? And that's why naming these dreams is so critical. And honestly, it's such an important principle that's woven into reality. Even if you're here today completely unconvinced about faith, you're not sure what you believe about Jesus, you're not sure about the Bible, you're not sure about any of this, you're just exploring, this principle will utterly work for you. Develop a delayed sense of gratification, name what you want 5 years, 10 years from now, and it will help you make choices. I'm not going to let what I want get in the way of what I really want. That said, this principle really gets traction in the lives of people who have submitted themselves to the Lord. Because some interesting new dimensions kind of come into that phrase. When you start to surrender to the Lord and you realize how much He loves us, how absolutely incredible He is to us, here are some things that start to get added into that. Not less than that, the what do I want for this life still matters, but in addition to that, you start to ask yourself questions like, what does God really want? Because when you think about Jesus on the cross and you imagine a God who loves us like that, where we messed up, but He didn't want to punish, He wanted to forgive. He wanted to pay the price Himself. And for me, the longer I've walked with Him and contemplated that, the more I've gotten to the point where I'm like, whatever I want, whatever everyone else wants, you're the one that has it figured out. And I want the world to go the way that you want the world to go. It is. I want what you want, honestly. And you start genuinely praying things like, thy will be done, thy kingdom come on heaven as it is in earth. In the language of this series, you start to say, I want God's dreams come true. And what God cares about in my dreams are great, but it's a side effect. Seek first His kingdom, and then these other things will be added to it. And that what I really want is God's dreams. And then my biggest dream, top of my dream list, is I want God. He's the best thing. He's better than everything. He's better than a life that goes well. He's better than a life that goes poorly. He's the best possible thing. The relationship with God is better than absolutely anything. So top of my dream list is, what do I really want? Well, I want Him. That's my dream. I want Him for now, and I want Him for forever. And words like these from Psalm 37 start to make sense to you. Take delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. So take delight in the Lord, and you'll get what you delight in. You get the desires of your heart. And then thirdly, as you kind of walk with the Lord, you start to take on an eternal perspective. And like I said, it's not that our dreams for today or a year from now or 10 years from now don't matter. I think they matter deeply to God, maybe even more to him than they do to us. But in addition to that, you start thinking about not just 10 years, 30 years from now, but 100 years from now, 10,000 years from now, a billion years from now, and not just for yourself, for everybody that you ever run into. Everybody spends forever somewhere. And so you talk about a sense of delayed gratification. When you change the time scale to include forever, now imagine that and bring that back to the phrase, don't let what you want get in the way of what you really want. So this takes on a whole new dimension for people who are following the Lord. I don't want you to make the mistake, though, of thinking that following the Lord means everything is going to go well for you right now, because it very often calls for an immense delayed sense of gratification. Jesus wanted to obey the Father's will perfectly, down to the detail. And it meant some really wonderful things for his life. I mean, his life was an enormous adventure, and he contributed more to humanity than any other person who's ever lived. And he had the deepest, truest relationships imaginable, and his life was characterized by a lot of joy. But his life was also characterized by a lot of loss and misunderstanding and accusation and torture and execution for others. It is not an easy thing to pursue God's dreams come true for you, and it requires a lifetime of vigilance, which is exactly what it required for Joseph. Look at verse 10. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even to be with her. This is what's so off-putting about temptation. All of us, I think, feel like, you know, if we faced a big dramatic test, we'd pass the test. So if it was like midnight and you were out on a deserted crossroads and a black cat crossed your path and the full moon came out from behind the clouds and there was the devil at the crossroads with a black hat and a contract. And he said, I'll give it all to you, wealth, talent, the ability to do backflips, women, whatever you want. Just sign on the dotted line and all I want from you is your eternal soul once you die. I think all of us would be like, no, sir. I'm not caving into that temptation. Very seldom in life is temptation that obvious, and it's almost never a one-time thing like that. In real life, it just grinds on and on. It wears on and on. That's part of the temptation. You're like, oh, everybody else at work is cheating, and it wears you down. Or you're like, nobody else is thinking about legacy and character and spiritual things, and it wears you down. Everybody else is like, I just want to get what I can get for me today, and it wears you down. And that turns out to be part of the test, because the real temptation is, as that wears on, as the season of testing is upon you, what will you choose to believe about God in the midst of that? And it becomes real easy to self-justify. It becomes real easy to say to yourself, well, I mean, if God didn't want me to do this, why wouldn't he just take it away? If God didn't want me to do this, why doesn't he do something about this? And no matter how long it goes on and how you feel about that, you need to remember that there are things that you really want. And temptation is a test that determines what you really want. So don't let what you want get in the way of what you really want, which is exactly what Joseph does. He stands up under this pressure until the day when it all comes to a head. Verse 11, one day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. Now, that probably felt like if you were like out in the woods and there was like birds chirping and squirrels like running around and chattering and butterflies fluttering around, and then all of a sudden it was like dead silent. You'd be like, what predator is around in these woods? I bet Joseph was like, is there a holiday that I missed or something like that? This turns out to be the calm before the storm in verse 12. She caught him by his cloak and said, come to bed with me. Now, what is it about Joseph's cloak? His clothes. It's like a theme that keeps popping up throughout this story. She says, come to bed with me. Now, this is the ultimate test. She has power over him. She's got his clothes in her hands. There's nobody in the house. Nobody's going to know. And she's physically pulling him towards the bedroom. Verse 12, but he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. Now, this is actually a very serious moment, so I don't want to joke about it, but I can't help myself. It's always funny when someone is holding someone by the coat and then they like slip their arms out of it to get away from them. And that's exactly what happens right here. She's got him by the cloak and he like slips his arms out of the cloak. So she's still holding his robe and he literally runs out of the house. Joseph literally runs from temptation. Now, why that tickles my funny bone, in the moment, it was deadly serious. The English playwright William Congreve very famously said, "Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned." I don't know if that's generally true. I try not to be too sexist, but in this case, it was absolutely true. Oh, she was mad. She was furious. She started plotting his destruction immediately. She hung onto that cloak, and throughout the rest of the day, she started having the servants come in and practicing her story on them. And she hung onto that cloak until Potiphar finally came home. Verse 16. She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. Then she told him this story. "That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." When his master heard the story his wife told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me," he burned with anger. This is my favorite scene in Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I'm going to butcher this, but at this point in the musical, the narrator says, "And letting out a mighty roar," and then Potiphar comes on the stage. He's like, "Ah!" The lights all come on or whatever. He is absolutely furious. And in verse 20, Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. Joseph is double betrayed. I mean, because of these dreams God had for him, his brothers turned their back on him. They sold him out, literally, into slavery. But then God gave him favor, and he rose the ranks in Potiphar's household, and everything was going well. And then a season of testing came upon him. And Joseph resisted. This woman is harassing him. This woman who had power over him was harassing him, and he refused. And then she turns around and accuses him of rape. Him. And then Potiphar comes home and he doesn't care. He doesn't care what Joseph has to say for himself. It's guilty until proven innocent. No judge, no jury, no right to face your accusers. In prison, lock the door, throw away the key. In all of this, though, Joseph was faithful. He kept God close to him. And he wouldn't respond to the temptation ultimately because he didn't want to sin against God. Joseph ran from temptation. He was a man who knew what he really wanted, and he didn't let what he wanted get in the way of what he really wanted. And so I want to recommend to you, friends, run from temptation. Literally run from temptation if you find yourself in a situation like Joseph's, but run from temptation and run from any theology that tells you this Christian life is nothing but happiness all the time. Run from any theology that tells you, if you just get this Christian thing right, if you just pray hard enough or have enough faith or do it the right way, everything is going to start going your way. You're going to get everything that you want. All of your problems are going to dissolve, and you're going to get what you want now. Because God's dreams for you are actually so much better than that, and they are not so cheaply purchased. Even after everything Joseph has gone through at this point, at this point in the story, he has still only made the down payment. Darker days and dangerous years and deeper disappointment still stands between Joseph and God's dreams come true. How will he react to this new devastating setback? Will he lose hope? Will he lose faith? Come back in 2 weeks for Act 3, Imprisoned, and find out what it means to be truly free.